Today's class is soil sampling and decision making using incremental sampling methodology. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training. Today's class was developed by the ITRC Incremental Sampling Methodology team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to quickly cover some introductory material in the next few slides and then turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC's team. Today's training is based on the web-based document, and on this slide too you can see a link to that document. We're going to introduce you to the document during today's training class, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we get started. Today's course is 2.25 hours. We are recording the session. Today, the trainers control the slides. If you want to control your own slides, you can download the training presentation. And that's back at that CLUIN training page where you started today. And you have to scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page to the session on download training materials in order to access those slides. We do look for your questions and feedback. Throughout today's training class, you can use that Q&A box in the lower right to ask questions. At the question and answer breaks, if you're on the phone line, you can unmute and ask questions out loud. We'll also ask those questions that came in using that Q&A box in the lower right. At the end of the class, we do ask that everyone fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. It's also your opportunity to create a certificate of participation for yourself. More information about ITRC is available on the website. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. We include federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full version of the ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty materials or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. I do encourage you to visit the ITRC website. There is more information available about new teams that are starting this year. It's a great time to review the website, see what resources are available, and how you can become more involved in ITRC. I'll introduce the trainers for today's class. All trainers are members of the ITRC Incremental Sampling Methodology team. Michael Stroh is a senior project manager with the Missouri Department of Natural Resources in Jefferson City. He joined the department in 1997 to oversee site assessment and cleanup activities in the state's voluntary cleanup program before joining the state Superfund site assessment group in 2002. Jay Clausen is a physical research scientist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory in Hanover, New Hampshire. Jay has conducted research on the application of incremental sampling methodology to military ranges containing energetics and metals in the particulate form, as well as the fate and transport of lead, tungsten, and energetics. Mark Bruce is the Corporate Technical Director for Test America. He has experience in environmental monitoring of metals, wet chemistry, volatile and semi-volatile organics, including sample preparation and analysis. He has participated in the development of several EPA methods. Tim Frederick is a human health risk assessor with the EPA Region 4 in Atlanta, Georgia. He provides risk assessment, toxicology, and other technical support to EPA's project managers on a wide variety of sites in the Southeast. On slide 6, I'll now turn today's presentation over to Michael Stroh from the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. Michael?
Thanks, Juliana, and good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, depending on your longitude, and welcome to the second part of our two-part training on ISM. I'm going to spend a few slides here just kind of going over some of the key concepts from last week, and then I'll give a quick preview of what we're going to cover today. And we like to use examples, so I'm going to kind of borrow one from last week on the site that you see in the photograph here today. And let's suppose that we have reason to suspect that the site here is contaminated and we're going to do an investigation there. And so as we talked about last week, we would start by stepping through the systematic planning process and developing our sampling objectives. And part of that, we talked about, was designating our decision units, or DUs. And remember, a DU is just simply a volume of soil that we need to make some sort of a decision about. And so when we got to the site and we do a reconnaissance, we would see these drums and we might consider that to be a contaminant source, or at least a potential one. So we might think about setting up the area right around those drums as a separate decision unit. We might call that a source area decision unit. And we might split the rest of the site up into smaller decision units, maybe including perimeter decision units to get a handle on how far the contamination might extend out.
An incremental sample from each of the decision units. And that would give us an estimate of the mean contaminant concentration. And that's a key point with ISM. As we mentioned before, we're always interested in the mean. If you need to get some statistic other than the mean, you would need to consider some other sampling technique. And there are a number of reasons we might be sampling a site like this. We might be doing this under the CERCLA or Superfund law in order to score it for inclusion on the national priorities list. Or maybe this is just a site that's being considered for purchase, and we're doing an environmental site assessment as part of a property transfer or due diligence transaction. But regardless of why we're sampling it, we pretty much all want the same thing. We want our samples to be accurate and to give us an accurate picture of what's going on at the site so that we can make good decisions. And to do that, we want to have representative samples. And a representative sample, that term's been used in the environmental field for a variety of different, in a variety of different ways. And so I just want to define it here for our purposes. We're calling a representative sample one which has the constituents or contaminants of interest in the sample in exactly the same proportions as they are in the decision unit. And if we go back, those of us have been around for a while, if we go back to the 1980s and look at the guidance documents that were around back then, it's clear that we used to think that a single discrete sample could give us could meaningfully represent an area or a volume of soil. So that's sort of the idea that, soil contamination is pretty much homogeneous. And we might use the analogy of a bowl of Cheerios. So wherever we go out and collect a sample there, we'll probably get a pretty similar answer. And we know now that that's not the case. Anyone that's ever looked at a data set with co-located discrete soil samples knows that's not the case. And Dina Crumbling described to us last week, she talked about soil principles and soil sampling theory, that why that isn't, it's in fact not the case. Because soil contamination is really more like a bowl of Fruit Loops, right? So there's a lot of heterogeneity, even across really short spatial scales. And so you can say, well, how bad is it really? And there was a study recently done, I believe it was just in 2016 by the state of Hawaii, where they looked at contaminant variability for a number, I think there were three separate contaminants at three different sites, with discrete sampling, and they found up to an order of magnitude difference in soil samples that were collected basically just adjacent to each other. So as Dina Crumbling likes to say from last week, heterogeneity rules. And we need to consider that and account for that by collecting representative samples. So how do we do that? And we can do that with incremental sampling. In this diagram, borrowing it from part one, we developed this to illustrate the overall incremental sampling process sort of together in one graphic. And I'll just step through it real quick again so that we're all on the same page. So the box here on the left represents a decision unit, and it's shown as two dimensions, but we know that all decision units have a depth and are three-dimensional. And the X's inside represent specific locations within that decision unit where we're going to collect an increment of soil. They're shown, 60 of them are shown in this example, and each one is typically about 40 to 50 grams, so we're going to end up combining all those increments of soil together into one container, which will be somewhere between 1 and 2 kilogram mass of soil, so much larger than we may be used to with discrete samples. And then we're going to send that sample into the laboratory, and instead of just scooping a few grams off the top, they're going to use a representative subsampling process, which you can basically think of as doing the same thing that we did out in the decision unit, but but doing it on a much smaller scale in the, on the laboratory bench. And they're going to end up with an analytical aliquot. And the idea is that that analytical aliquot is going to represent the container of soil that was sent into the lab, and the container of soil is going to represent the decision unit that was collected from. So people often ask, well, aren't these just composite samples? And they're really not, not in the way that that word has historically been used. The incremental samples are carefully built and highly structured samples, and they're designed to avoid the problems that we typically run into with discrete samples that are caused by heterogeneity. The next slide here, we see the roadmap for orientation. And except for a few slides at the beginning of last week's presentation, we organized this internet training in the same way as the guidance document was written. So, for example, today we're going to start by talking about field implementation. And if you wanted to dig in and read more about field implementation, you would go to Section 5 of the guidance document. All right, I'll just get to a quick summary then of the main topics we talked about in Part 1. Dina Crumbling talked about soil sampling theory and told us about how, you know, several decades now of field experience have shown us that heterogeneity rules, and that's the problem we run into with discrete sampling. Discrete samples are typically not capable of capturing the true nature of a decision unit because they're too small and there's typically not enough of them. So to get over that, we need to collect big samples, and we need those samples to include soil from all across the decision unit. Robin Boyd talked about the systematic planning process, and that's something we should be doing at all of our sites. And we talked about how we sort of intentionally baked that into the ISM process. Roger Brewer is with the state of Hawaii. He's been doing ISM for over 10 years now. And when he talks about systematic planning, he likes to quote Albert Einstein, I'll paraphrase, who said that if I had 1 hour to solve the problems of the world, I'd spend 59 minutes explaining the problem and 1 minute explaining the answer. And it's really the same idea with ISM. So we need to do the systematic planning up front and think hard about our DU designations so that when we go out into the field, if we've done it right, ISM can be as simple as just putting increments of soil in a bag. Phil Goodrum laid out the statistical foundation for ISM, and he described how, and because we do get representative samples, they can provide us with a reproducible estimate of the mean. So each time we go out and collect an incremental sample from the same decision unit, we're liable to get the same result or fairly close to it. And he also talked about the importance of collecting field replicates. And remember, those give us our measure of precision, and they also allow us to calculate an upper confidence limit if that's a part of the project. Okay, so that's part one. Today we're going to talk about the fun part, the process of collecting and processing an incremental sample. Jay Clausen's going to come on next and talk about how we go about collecting an incremental sample out in the field. And then Mark Bruce will cover the laboratory aspects of ISM, so what happens to the sample once it's received at the lab. And then Tim Frederick will come on and introduce the concept of decision mechanisms. And so he'll tell us how we can use ISM data to make decisions about sites. And then I'll come back on again at the end, and we'll take a look at some specific applications where we might think about using ISM. And then I'll talk a little bit about costs. And so now I'm going to turn it over to Jay Clausen now with the U.S. Army Cold Regions Research and Engineering Lab to talk about field implementation. Jay?
Okay, thank you for the introduction, Michael. So I'm going to be talking about the fun part, and that's the part where we go out in the field and collect our soil samples. So at the end of this particular module, you'll have the information on how to collect an ISM sample, and you should be able to understand the similarities and differences between surface and subsurface ISM sampling, and you should be able to understand the issues specific to non-volatile and volatile ISM sampling. And then you should be able to implement and collect replicate ISM samples as well. So the topics that I'm going to be going through today include the sample design, different types of sampling tools, the approaches for surface and subsurface ISM sampling, and also including cores and subsampling issues. Get into a little bit about contaminants of concern, mainly between volatile and non-volatile samples, and then I'll be talking about replicate samples. If you've had a chance to look through the ISM document, you've seen this figure. It's in figure 5.1. And basically, it steps you through the process of deciding on how to go about collecting your ISM samples. And the process can either be simple or complex. It really depends on your site conditions. So, you know, what soil matrix are you, or what do you have at the site? What's your contaminant concern? What are your DKOs? What are your objectives? So it's basically a multiple-step process you go through, and you really don't want to be going through this in the field. You want to do this during the systematic planning phase of your project, so before you get out in the field. And again, you can refer to the TechReg document to step you through this process. So there are a number of different sample collection components. In regards to the decision unit, there are three different types of sampling designs, and I'll go through each of those in the following slide. Basically, there's a simple random approach, random sampling within a grid, and then the systematic random sampling. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about sampling tools, the need for a core shape type tool, and a minimum adequate diameter of the tool itself. And the reason these two issues are important, it limits the error. And in fact, these concepts are actually based on soil sample theory. Surprise, surprise, there actually is a theory associated with collecting samples. It's not as simple as just collecting a sample and throwing it into a bucket. And so the last thing I'll be talking a little bit about is the mass of the sample, both the individual increment mass, and then the total sample mass itself. So these are the three different sampling designs. There are advantages and disadvantages for each of them. And basically, all three of them yield the unbiased estimate of the mean. All three approaches are appropriate for ISM. When I say I'm biased, I mean every soil particle has an equal chance of being collected and analyzed, going back to what Michael talked about earlier. And then random, I don't necessarily mean wherever the sampling team wants to collect the increment or the sample. We actually use a random approach that's systematic, and I'll talk about that. And then just recall that, again, these are two-dimensional representations of a sampling design. There is the third component, which is depth. So you got to keep that in mind. And then typically, I think you probably heard this on day one of the IBT training, but we recommend 30 increments as a minimum per decision unit. So if we look at the bottom design, the systematic random design, this is typically the approach that most people use. It's the most efficient to implement in the field. It's probably the easiest to implement. And this particular approach basically yields a relatively even spatial distribution of increments across the decision unit. You can kind of see that equal, each of the increment locations is equidistant from each other. And Michael has gone through on how you collect the sample. I'll just reemphasize that again, that you either locate the corners of your grid and mark them in some manner, and then maybe use lane markers or flagging or something like that. And then get an idea of how many increments you want to collect within the decision unit and how many increments per lane. And then if you kind of envision in your head as you're out there in the field that you have a series of grids in front of you, you decide where your random location is within that first grid, collect that increment from that location, step over to the next grid, and at the same random location within the grid, collect another increment, put it in your sample container, and work your way back and forth across the decision unit. A little more complex is the simple random design. So it's a random approach in terms of the selection of the increment locations. And the drawback of this particular approach, as you can see in the figure, there are some increment locations that are close together, and there are others that are further apart. So in some cases, you're biasing your sample from a certain spatial area within the decision unit, and in other areas you're underrepresenting. The random within the grid is kind of a compromise between the two, but you can still see there are issues where some of your increment locations are close together, and then other instances they're further apart. So this is the Florida case study. You've probably seen this earlier. What they did here at this particular site is they flagged the corners of the decision unit, and then they used flag to mark the lanes, if you will, of the decision unit. And recall from day one at this particular site, it was a former golf course. Arsenic was the contaminant of concern, and the DU decision unit is about a quarter acre in size. And again, they used the typical investigation tools for delineating this area. They could have used surveying in this particular case. They GPS and flagged the corners of the decision unit. And then they put flagging at the intersection of each of the grids, if you will, within the decision unit. And then they actually used string to run as the grid lanes. And, you know, on a site that's open like this, I probably would mark the four corners of the decision unit and pretty much be done with it. And then I would do a series of pacing to decide how many lanes I have. And then how many increments per lane, and then I would just basically pace off from my initial random starting location. After I've collected my increment, I would step off to the next location at a certain pace distance and then proceed working my way back and forth across the decision unit. In situations where it's heavily vegetated, obviously you could lose your way or get off of your line in terms of where you're moving, and so you may want to use more flagging or some other types of devices to keep you basically walking in a straight path. So in this particular slide here, we're showing a couple different decision units. The photo on the left shows a decision unit for a transformer pad, and the photo on the right is a residential backyard. And you'll notice that these particular decision units are not necessarily rectangular in shape. You can have basically any geometric design for your decision you want, although it's, typically easier to work with a rectangle in terms of determining your increment spacing and the number of increments per decision unit. In these particular examples, the actual increment locations are flagged. This might assist somebody that's inexperienced with ISM, but generally we don't flag the individual increment locations because basically, we're not collecting any information about those locations. Recall, you're collecting an increment, putting it in a sample container, collecting another increment, putting it in the same sample container, and at the end, you have one sample which is being analyzed. And so information on that sample applies to the whole area, not to the individual increments. Again, we use the same, types of marker tools that we've used for typical grab type sampling. You can use flagging, tape, markers, what have you, GPS, survey grids, pin flags. So it's the same tools that you're familiar with. Here we're back at the Florida case study site again. In this particular example, they marked the corners of the decision unit with the red flags, and then the intersection of the grids, if you will, within the decision unit were marked with white flags, as well as at the edges of the decision unit. again, because we're interested in the average concentration across the entire decision unit, and our sample is yielding that information, and we're not, you know, we're not obtaining any information about the individual increments, there's really no need to survey or GPS the coordinates of those individual increments. And in fact, that would take away from the efficiency of this type of sampling. So let's switch topics a little bit and talk about sampling tool considerations. The primary criteria is shape. Typically, you want a cylindrical or core-shaped tool. And typically, there's a minimum diameter size, which is based on the particle size or the soil fraction of interest. So generally, if you have a particle size of 2 millimeters that you're interested in, then the recommended core diameter is going to be about 16 millimeters in size. And the basic thought process there is that you don't want to have a cobble or something that's not going to fit into your sample device. And the purpose for the core or cylindrical shaped tool is you want to get a consistent volume of soil. And if you recall, if you've done sampling in the past with any sort of scoops, that most of the sample is derived from the surface or the top of the hole. And at the tip of the hole or the bottom of the hole, very little material is obtained. So your sample is basically biased to the surface. So that's the reason why we like the core shape tools. Again, you should have a tool that has an appropriate depth so you collect your sample across the entire vertical thickness of the decision unit you desired. So if your decision unit is 6 inches thick, then you want to have a tool that will allow you to collect a 6-inch core. And again, we typically like to collect our core sample across the entire Z dimension of the decision unit. And if we go to the next slide, 21, there are a number of considerations to consider. One is decontamination of the tools. So because you're collecting individual increments that are being combined together into a single sample, in a sense, the individual increments are part of the whole, if you will. And so there's no need to decontaminate between individual increments. And if you're collecting replicate samples from a decision unit, so those would be 3 independent samples, you don't necessarily really need to decon between those, but I have talked to a statistician in the past, and to have truly independent samples from a statistical basis, then, you know, best management practice would be to decon between those replicate samples so that the samples are truly independent. Now, if we're talking about sampling between different decision units, those are different samples, and therefore we would need to decon between those sample collections. Again, the sampling tool should be appropriate for the matrix or the contaminant of interest. This is the step sampler type of a tool. It's basically like a flower planter bulb type of device. You step on it, it pushes a core barrel into the ground, and then you extrude or remove that, and then there's a little plunger that extrudes the sample, as you can see here on the right, into somebody's hand. There are a variety of sampling tools out there on the market. At the top is the EVC incremental sampler, and the bottom there is the JMC Backsaver handle and soil tools tubes. The agricultural industry has a variety of sample tools. And if we look here, this is a percussion type hammer tool used for hard packed or gravelly type of soils. So again, you want a tool that's appropriate for the soil conditions at the site. Here at the Florida case study, again, they use this plunger type of a tool where they stepped on the core barrel and then extruded a sample, in this case, into a bucket. I typically like to use plastic baggies to put my samples in and then seal them with zip ties. And the purpose for that, or the reason for that, is they're easier to handle, they're easier to pack and into a cooler, and easier to ship than buckets. So that's just my preference there. There are also low-tech sampling tools. Here we're back at the Florida case study site. In one of the decision units, they took, I believe these are 6-inch lengths of PVC pipe, or they might have been a foot, and then pounded them into the ground, and then they pulled them out. And you can see on the bumper of the pickup truck about 30 increments of soil or 30 cores, and then they extruded this material into a single sample container, and that constituted their sample from the decision unit. I've had good success in the past using a 50cc syringe where I cut off the tip, and then I just push that device into unconsolidated soil, and it generally holds the soil pretty well. And then I use the plunger of the syringe to extrude my sample into my sample container. And I've used that to collect 100 increment samples from decision unit. They work, you know, really well. They're relatively cheap. And then when you're done sampling the decision unit, you can dispose of it easily. I had mentioned, again, adequate sample mass. There is an equation where you can sit down and calculate it, shown here. Typically, most of the tools that we use will yield an individual increment mass somewhere between 20 and 60 grams. And our final ISM samples with all the increments combined will, you know, be somewhere between 600 and 2,500 grams. So this is quite a bit larger sample than a typical grab sample. If you're familiar with putting samples into a 4-ounce glass jar, those jars hold about 200 grams of material. So we're collecting quite a bit more material than in the past. The nice thing about the core shape sampling tool is that if you collect the sample consistently across the decision unit, you know, same depth every time, then the volume of material you collected is going to be constant, and the mass more or less will be constant too. You know, the mass could vary to some degree. You know, it depends on the soil density, the moisture content of your soil, and then obviously the diameter of your sample tool will determine you know, what your individual increment mass and ultimately your total final ISM sample mass. One point to make is we don't typically weigh the individual increments in the field. We simply combine the increments to get a total sample. We will weigh the final sample basically to determine the moisture content, as you would with any sort of grab sample. But it's really not necessary to weigh the individual increments. Again, our assumption is if you're consistently collecting your sample over the full depth interval that you're interested in, then you're collecting a constant volume of material, and the sample mass should be about the same. I mean, there'll be some discrepancy, but the error associated with that discrepancy would be pretty small. So let's talk about subsurface decision units. We can use ISM not only for collecting surface soil samples, but we can collect subsurface soil samples. So here we have an image with four decision units depicted. DU1 is from the surface, or a foot below the surface to 1.5 feet below the surface. And then we have a second decision unit from 1.5 feet to 3 feet, and so on. Again, just like in the surface soil sampling, we want 30 increments. So in this case, you would be doing 30 borings and then combining all those increments together. So in this case, all the DU1 samples would consist of the 30 borings from a half foot below the surface to 1.5 feet below the surface. As you can imagine, that could take a fair amount of time depending on your soil conditions. A GeoProbe rig works pretty well and works pretty quickly. But again, if you're having a site where you have a number of decision units, you know, that boring time or drilling time could add up pretty quickly. I've tried to take a shortcut in some cases on some projects where I've collected a smaller number of increments or less borings, and it, you know, has increased the error associated with the sample. So you've got to kind of weigh, you know, the cost-benefit type analysis there. And then there's another issue that we're going to get into, and that is the sample mass. As you can imagine, if we're collecting a a foot-long core, and we're collecting 30 of them or combining them together, that's quite a volume or mass of soil. And that may be more than we want to ship to the laboratory. So what do we do in that case? Well, we've come up with two different techniques. One's referred to as the core wedge, and the other is the core slice, subsampling alternatives. And this allows us to decrease the volume or the mass of the soil that we're ultimately sending to the laboratory for analysis. And again, as you can imagine, when we're combining borings together, it wouldn't be uncommon to have a sample that, you know, be 10 or 20 kilograms in mass. And I'm sure the lab would receive that, but they may not be too happy about it, and they probably would charge you a lot of money for it. So the first approach that I mentioned was the core wedge. In its simplest is to take the core and with some sort of trowel or knife or spatula, cut this core in half, and now you've reduced the volume or the mass of soil by one half, and that may be sufficient for your needs. Oftentimes we'll collect a wedge of material, so we'll basically cut a pie slice, if you will, from the core, as you can see here, along the entire length, or whatever our decision unit depth interval is, and then we'll take that whole wedge of material and put that in our sample container, and that constitutes one increment, and then we go to the next core and take that next wedge and combine it together and so on. A general rule of thumb is that you want your wedge width to be larger than the diameter of your largest grain size material. So you don't want a cobble that would not fit it within your wedge slice or your wedge. You know, if you had a large cobble, then you'd have to make the decision, well, should this cobble go in the sample container or should I, you know, toss it out? And really don't want to be making those sorts of biased decisions in the field. The other approach is the core slice. This is a less preferred approach, and it may be a little bit more complicated to conduct in the field. It offers the opportunity, though, to reduce your volume or mass of material more substantially than the core wedge. So if you envision in this particular case, we have a core that's maybe 2 foot in length from our first boring or increment locations. And what we would do there is we would take a slice of material from that core, say in this particular case, 0 to 4 inches, and we would put that into our sample container. And then we would go to our second boring or our second increment, and at that boring, instead of going from 0 to 4 inches, we would take a slice of material, say 4 to 8 inches. And we would do that, you know, as we worked our way through the subsequent cores. The problem with this particular approach, as you can imagine, is if you're at one spatial location and say we're at location 3 and that core slice is from 8 to 12 inches but your contaminant's sitting at the surface, then you're going to miss the contaminant. So that's the reason the core wedge is preferred, because you're getting a cut of material that's through the entire thickness of the decision unit, whereas the core slice, it's kind of a systematic random collection of depth intervals. We'll switch gears again and talk about field processing for non-volatile samples. So each step of processing a sample introduces sample error. So typically we like to do any sort of sample processing in the laboratory because it's a controlled environment and it minimizes any sort of error. But there may be situations where you need to do processing in the field, such as I just mentioned with the subsurface samples, where you have a large volume of material and you don't want to send that all to the laboratory. We have done subsampling in the field, so following the sieving, we have some sort of cookie tray, if you will, and we spread our sieve material out onto the tray and try to get a uniform thickness, and then we collect systematic random increments, typically 30 again, across the tray. This sometimes is referred to as the 2D Japanese slab cake approach. Generally, we don't recommend subsampling for situations where we have contaminants in the form of particulates, such as energetics or metals. In that case, we would want to take the entire sieve fraction, send it back to the laboratory, and mill it or grind it, and then subsample it. And I guess you could do the milling in the field, although that might be a little more complicated to do. And then in the laboratory, when we're doing our subsampling, you know, we prefer a core shape type tool. That's probably not really practical. So another approach that works equally well is some sort of rectangular shaped tool that has a flat bottom and sides that allows you to get or obtain a sample across the entire thickness of the material that's been spread out onto your tray. Generally, we don't recommend a spoon-shaped sampling tool. You're running the same issue as you would out in the field, in that you're going to get a biased sample with most of the material coming from the top of your tray of spread-out material and a minimum amount of material from the bottom of the thickness or at the tray surface. So, again, the sample is being biased. So at the Florida case study site, the final ISM samples that they collected were somewhere between 600 and 2,500 grams. They used a variety of containers to ship their samples. In some cases, they used baggies and put them in coolers. In other cases, they had samples placed into plastic buckets. And then the samples were shipped to the laboratory to facilitate processing of the sample and subsampling prior to analysis. So one of the key things to point out is the fact that you know, coordination or communication with the laboratory is critical. They need to know how you've collected the samples and the volume of material that you're going to be sending them and what type of containers and that sort of thing. So let's talk a little bit about volatile sampling. There are some tools available that you've probably used with grab sampling. These are the same type of tools we'll use with the ISM samples. I think what we have here in the photograph on the left is Core-in-One tool, and then in the center is the TerraCore sampler, and then on the right is the EasyDraw syringe and power stop. And what we like about these particular tools is they basically yield a core shape type sample or consistent volume material as long as you sample through the proper depth of interest, and so they're getting a similar mass. Again, these tools have been developed specifically for VOC samples, and typically you know, the core increment is about 5 grams of material. And then this material is field preserved, typically with containers that have been pre-weighed with methanol. And I'll talk about that in a second here. We have done volatile sampling in the subsurface. Again, you have a core, and you use those coring type tools to collect an increment, and you extrude that increment into your prepared sample container. And so if you collect 30 increments, that could be about 150 grams of material as your total sample. So you can see in the photograph on the right where we have a core and a number of increments been collected, and those increments are combined into individual sample. Typically when I've been doing VOC sampling, I like to get everything ready to go. And then what I like to do is split my core in half so that I have a fresh surface and I'm not having any volatile losses, and then I quickly collect my increments with the VOC samplers. So I mentioned this a little bit before about the sampling container. We were basically extruding our VOC samples into some sort of container that has methanol. And that's to preserve the sample and to prevent any volatile losses. And so typically you need to coordinate with your analytical laboratory and, you know, converse with them on the size and the number of increments that are going to be collected so that they can provide you with the appropriate volume of methanol. And basically, you want your samples to be submerged within the methanol. So you don't want to have so much material and not enough methanol that, you know, your samples are exposed to the headspace. Mark will get into this, but there are some shipping restrictions in regards to larger volumes of methanol via DOT regulations, so you need to be aware of that. So one concept we haven't talked about yet is the replicate samples. And basically, replicates are samples that are collected from our same decision unit, but alternate random locations. So these aren't split samples, but these are independent samples. And typically, we like to collect a minimum of 3 replicates for statistical evaluation. And basically, what we do is we calculate a relative standard deviation for those 3 replicates. And that will give us some information about the error associated with both the sample collection and sample processing and analytical methods. And we have some rules of thumbs that we use in terms of what's an acceptable RSD and what's not. So typically the way I do replicate samples is recall that we have our decision unit, we have a random location within the grid that we start out with, and then we consistently collect increments from that same random location as we move through the decision units. I typically have one person that's a sample collector, and then either one or two people that are bag holders, and I have basically the sampler collect the samples from the 3 replicate locations, or 3 individual locations at the same time. So basically we're collecting the samples in parallel as we're going. Obviously, you got to make sure that the appropriate replicate is going into this appropriate sample container as you move through the field. Preferred way probably would be to, collect your one sample with all your increments from the decision unit, bag that up, then go back out in the field and collect your second replicate of samples, and then come back and then go out and do your third. I just find it's more efficient to do it all at once. You have to be a little bit more organized when you do that, but it definitely is quicker to do that way. And sometimes, depending on the degree of heterogeneity at the site, 3 replicates may not be enough to capture the sample error. And so, in some cases, you may need more replicates. And, the other thing that we use for the replicates is we can also do a statistical evaluation to calculate the 95% UCL of the mean. And I think there was some discussion of that during the statistical session on day one. And I think Tim is going to talk a little bit about that later this afternoon as well. So there's actually 2 purposes for collecting the replicate samples. And again, this is how, we proceed through the process to collect replicate samples. Michael went through this earlier, but basically we have, a replicate 1 is our yellow triangles, and then a replicate 2 is the green circles, and replicate 3 is the stars. And as you can see on the right, you could do 3 different patterns of sample collection in the field. In that sense, you have a truly independent sample. Again, for efficiency, I like to collect all 3 replicates at the same time, but from 3 different random locations within the grid, if you will, within the decision unit. Again, the replicates need to be collected in the same manner as your original sample. So, if you're going to use a systematic random design for your replicate or your original sample 1, then replicates 2 and 3, need to be systematic random samples as well. The same depth interval need to be collected, the same number of increments should be collected. They don't, when you're going out in the field and stepping through the site using, consistent spacing of steps or whatever, there may be a situation where one replicate bag has one more increment than another, and that's not necessarily a problem there. And then the analysis and the processing of each of these samples needs to be the same as well, so that you can have a apples-to-apples comparison. Here's another example of a field replicate. In this case, I think it was a something like a spoils pile material that was flattened with a bulldozer. In this case, it's very coarse material, and I guess they didn't have access to percussion hammers, so they're out there with a spade collecting their replicates. So you can see there's three holes within each of the grids. So there's replicate one, replicate two, and replicate three. And you can also see, too, that, you know, the top of the hole, if you will, is being overrepresented versus the bottom of the hole. The holes are kind of a triangular type shape, where the bottom of the hole is being underrepresented. So a few reminders on replicate samples. Again, during the systematic planning phase of your project, you need to decide, you know, what type of replicates, how many you're going to collect, where and when they'll be collected, and how will those samples be evaluated. Again, we don't need to homogenize or mix the samples in the field, because the systematic random collection process in the field is basically mixing your samples to some degree, and then typically we're often subsampling in the laboratory, which is further mixing, if you will, of the samples, or in some cases we're grinding or milling the soils down. So all of these processing steps are basically homogenizing or mixing our samples. So in summary, the sample design, the sampling tools that you're going to use, whether you're going to collect surface or subsurface soils, what's your contaminant of concern, whether it's volatiles or non-volatiles, and the number and degree of replicates. All this needs to be decided during the systematic planning stage, so you need to do this before you're done in the field. And that pretty much ends the field sampling phase of this part of the session, and Mark Bruce is going to be up next talking about analytical considerations.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jay. All right. So let's continue on. In part one, you heard how important the upfront planning is, and Jay has just discussed how important it is to collect the field sample in using the right techniques and the right processes. And now we need to maintain that same level of effort as we move into the laboratory processing part of this. So what we're going to do in the next part of this presentation is to talk about how to match the laboratory processing options with the different analytes and the different data uses or objectives. And specifically, we're going to talk about managing sample moisture, how you select appropriate particle sizes, if necessary, how you reduce particle size, how to collect the subsamples for analysis, and then what some of the ripple effects are related to quality assurance, and also what we'll touch on laboratory certification options. Now, on this particular flow chart, particularly if you're sitting in the back of the room, I don't expect you to be able to read it. It's figure 6-1 from the ITRC ISM guidance document. But it's up here to indicate that there are choices to be made with regard to what the laboratory processing options are. There is no one-size-fits-all. So what we want to do is we want to make sure that we pick the right options so that we end up with more representative subsamples and ultimately produce better precision. What we want to do is avoid picking the wrong option, which can produce a poor and, in some cases, even an unknown bias. So it's important to include the lab processing during the project planning. Please don't treat the lab like a black box where you just feed it dirt. Expect that the lab will automatically know whatever the right thing to do is and automatically produce high-quality data that is appropriate for your decision-making. So one of the early things that we need to do is to define what are the analytes, contaminants of concern, contaminants of potential concern. Shown on this slide are a number of the common analyte groups whether it's volatiles, energetics, metals, pesticides, herbicides, etc. And it's important to not only list those, but the specific compounds within each of those groups, because in some cases there's a wide range of physical and chemical characteristics, and we need to make sure that those get taken into account when we're choosing the laboratory processing options. Now, Jay previously mentioned VOC sampling and analysis. So we're going to circle back and we're going to touch on that again. Basically, what we're using is a scaled-up version of EPA Method 5035, which is includes a methanol preservation option. So we have a variety of sizes of bottles from a large, as shown here, where we essentially collect all the increments in one bottle and scale the amount of methanol up appropriately. We can even use the small individual discrete sample bottles. It just depends on what the trade-offs are between labor versus shipping costs. Now, there are some analytical sensitivity limitations. Methanol preserved samples do tend to have higher reporting limits than some of the discrete sample low-level analysis options. But if you're working with a short list of analytes, selected ion monitoring, gas chromatography, mass spectrometry can be one way of addressing some of those reporting limitations. Now, as Jay mentioned, and I forgot, there is a DOT restriction related to if you got more than 30 milliliters of methanol. And basically, it's a limitation particularly related to air shipment. Ground shipment, either with a lab courier or with a commercial carrier, are significantly less restrictive. Going to the Florida case study, for this particular site, arsenic was the analyte of interest, and it had been applied as a liquid or a fine powder in some pesticide and herbicide uses. In the upcoming slides, we've got some symbols on them. If it's a green arrow, that means it's good. If it's a striped red arrow, it means that's a bad effect. If the arrow is pointing up, it means that the results or statistic is getting larger in value. If it's pointing down, it means it's getting smaller. Let's take a look at our lab processing roadmap. We're going to look at sample conditioning next. After that, particle size reduction, and then at the end, splitting and subsampling. So in terms of conditioning the sample, what is most common, although not universal, is to dry it at room temperature in some sort of ventilation hood. And the goal here is to, technical about it, produce dry, crushable chunks of dirt, which then we can disaggregate and then work well with the other processes that follow that. But we do need to consider the possibility of volatilization losses of some of those analytes. The lower the boiling point, if it's not strongly bound to the soil particles, there's the greater potential for actually losing some of this during the air drying step. So there is a potential for loss table within the ISM guidance. And we kind of have a little excerpt from that here, with naphthalene perhaps being one of the greater possibilities of being lost during this air drying step, acetonaphthene kind of moderate, and then benzoapyrene, actually very little potential for losing that because it's a very high boiling PAH. There are some other options when drying is not appropriate, but we don't have time to go into a lot of those details due to time limitations. Turning back to the Florida case study, since arsenic is a high boiling analyte, volatilization loss was not expected. So I said, okay, we're gonna start with the most common air drying. I do need to define a few terms. Grinding, humans have been doing that for a few thousand years, and it's a rather generic term that has a whole bunch of different meanings. So when having that discussion with the laboratory, need to make sure we discuss what type of equipment is going to be used or describe what the specific lab processes are. A couple of other terms that are a little bit more specific. The first is disaggregation, which I had previously mentioned. And that basically means we're breaking up the soil clumps into individual particles. But the small pebbles and the hard crystalline materials, those stay intact. This might be sticking it in a bladed coffee chopper and basically busting up the dirt clods. It might mean putting it on the surface of a sieve and crunching it with like the back of a spoon or something like that. For milling, that's complete particle size reduction, where basically we mill everything into smaller particles so that it ends up with the entire thing being like a flour-like consistency. And what's shown here is the picture of a stainless steel puck mill, where essentially the sample goes into the bowl. We throw in this large metal puck and put it all into this big shatter box that basically moves the puck around inside of the mill, and it crushes everything between the puck and the sidewall. Circling back to the Florida case study, we did disaggregation and sieving to remove particles that were greater than 2 millimeters in size. Since the contaminants were spread out as a liquid, we were expecting that the nugget effect was going to be relatively small. This was a comparison study, so a portion of the sample was done with milling using a stainless steel puck mill, and another portion was done without. So back to our roadmap, now we're going to turn and look in a little bit more detail as to what our particle size reduction options are. Now, if you'll pardon the pun on Shakespeare, to mill or not to mill is an excellent question, and it's generally recommended when we've got crystalline particles or fibrous threads or paint chips, and this most commonly shows up when we're dealing with energetics, explosives, or metals. So this is, reduces the variability, it reduces subsampling error, and it facilitates mixing when we can get the entire sample in the mill at the same time. And in general, it basically improves precision. Now, there are some instances where milling is not recommended. If we've got a volatile or thermally labile analyte, in some instances, it can increase the apparent availability of a contaminant of concern because we essentially, in doing the particle size reduction, we reduce more commonly metals into the measurement process that previously had been locked up in some of the hard crystalline particles. So some examples where we might want to stay away from milling if we are really concerned about the monochloro-PCB congeners, some of the more reactive semi-volatile organics, things like decane. There have even been some questions asked about elemental mercury, although I haven't actually seen any study results on that yet. So from a limitations perspective, we need to consider analyte losses. If we're working with a metallic mill, we need to consider the possibility of metals contamination of the sample. And as previously mentioned, there is the potential for a high bias for some types of decision-making to increase the measured metals concentration, and for some risk assessment scenarios, that might be considered a negative. So if someone is uncertain, it's actually possible to go ahead and split the sample, do a portion of it with milling and another portion without. So if you've made the decision to go ahead and mill, then there are a number of different mechanisms that we can use for milling. The upper right-hand corner, we have a picture of a puck mill. This is what's specified in method 8330B. A ball mill in the lower right-hand corner, essentially a paint can with some ceramic grinding media. And then there is the old-fashioned mortar and pestle, either manual as shown here, or there are automated versions of that. So we need to consider what are the analytes of interest and the concentrations of interest and what the mill materials are. And ultimately, what particle size do we need? Back to the Florida case study, as mentioned before, this was a comparison, and the results actually confirmed that milling wasn't especially needed for this particular part of the site. There was a small precision improvement with milling, but it wasn't dramatic, and there was essentially no change in the mean concentration. Taking a look next at splitting and subsampling, one of the statistician favorites is what we call the rotary sectoral splitter, where the sample goes into the hopper in the upper right-hand corner of this picture, and is slowly fed out a little bit at a time into a series of rotating jars. And essentially what this does is it splits the sample with this particular machine into 8 smaller subsamples, and it does it in a very statistically sound way. There are a few of these out in the commercial environmental lab world, but they tend to be a little bit less frequent because there is some additional equipment cost, but the biggest downside is the need to clean in between samples. And that particular labor is undesirable at present. What is definitely more common is to use the two-dimensional Japanese slab cake, and it can be used either with a dried sample or a wet sample. Divide it up into a grid, very much like one does in the field, and you collect an increment from each of the different grid locations, and then combine those all into a single analytical subsample. Now, it's important to use the right type of tool when collecting those increments. You know, in the field, you know, Jay was describing the cylindrical coring devices, and again, at the lab, we want to make sure that we collect the top, middle, and bottom in roughly equal proportions. So we want a blunt-end tool with sides to keep the particles from falling off. Circling back to the Florida case study, in this particular instance, we used the 2D slab cake for subsampling. It's lower cost than the sectoral splitter, but significantly more representative than that long time ago tradition in the environmental lab of dig a spot off of the top of the jar. Now, one of the things that we want to take into account in some instances, particularly if we have not used milling, is that larger particles make getting representative subsamples more difficult. And if you take a look at this particular graph, the blue line in particular, you can see that the larger the particle size, the larger the percent relative standard deviation one should expect. This kind of makes sense. Bigger particles are harder to represent in a small subsample. And this graph illustrates that as particle size gets smaller, in other words, you do milling, then there is a significant improvement in precision. However, sometimes, as previously mentioned, it's not desirable to do milling. So in that case, we can go ahead and increase the subsample size, and that is another way of helping to manage some of the representativeness challenges. Back to the Florida case study, in this particular instance, since we weren't expecting a whole lot of microscale heterogeneity, we used 2-gram subsamples. In a lot of other instances, particularly when working with non-milled samples, a lot of the commercial ISM labs are now set up to do 5 and 10-gram metals preps. From a quality control perspective, there isn't a single matrix that is considered clean for all analytes of interest. So we've got a limited number of clean matrices to work with, and they're very much handled on a case-by-case basis. For laboratory control samples and matrix spikes, it's not particularly practical at this point in time to do large-scale spiking on kilogram-sized samples due to high cost. So that limits the availability. So typically, we introduce those particular QC elements after the ISM processing is complete. However, doing subsampling replicates is very common in a way of assessing what kind of heterogeneity or reproducibility one has at that point in the process. The Florida case study ran into some challenges trying to use sand as a blank. Turned out that the metals content of that sand was both too high and too variable. So, the laboratory control sample and matrix spike were added after the ISM processing for practical considerations. From a laboratory certification perspective, NELAP is aware of ISM. There are some non-NELAP state accreditations. By far, the agency-specific accreditation that is the most familiar with ISM is the DOD Environmental Laboratory Approval Program. There are some reference methods that mention ISM-type processing. Method 8330B, Appendix A for explosives, was the first one to come out of the EPA. There is an update to method 3050, and it's actually 3050C. Jay and I are involved in that work group, and actually that is scheduled for update 6 of SW846, hopefully later on in 2017. There are a few other reference documents. There's an ASTM method, D6323, that talks about some ISM-like processing. There's an older EPA document from 2003, authored by Gerlach, that also talks about subsampling procedures, and then obviously there's the laboratory standard operating procedure for labs that are set up to do this. So to summarize, it's kind of like building an arch. We've got to get the foundations right and then get the keystone in at the at that final piece. So we need to make sure that we want to match the processes and the analyte needs so that we're actually producing data that is appropriate for the decisions to be made. And that starts with managing sample moisture. Then we need to appropriately disaggregate the soil sample, determine whether or not to mill, and then act appropriately there. And then finally, we need to collect a correct subsample using the proper tools and processes. So with that, I will turn it back over to Juliana for our first question and answer break.
Thanks, Mark. We are going to have time now to ask questions out loud. So if you are if you're on the phone line, you're welcome to unmute and ask a question out loud. Most people are going to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right, and you are welcome to send in those questions at any time during the training class. I'll also mention at this point, before we wrap up today, we do hope that you take just a few minutes to fill out the feedback form. So if you leave before we end the class today, please go to the feedback form. It's in that related links, the middle right, the fourth item down. You select feedback, and then you look down a bit, select browse to. That's going to open that feedback form for you. We really do use the information you provide, and we appreciate taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. It's also your opportunity to create a certificate of participation for yourself. The only way to do that is by completing the feedback form, check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. When you submit the feedback, the system's going to generate that certificate. So if you forget to check the box, just go back and be sure to check that box, because the only way to get it now is by submitting the feedback with that box checked. We'll get to some questions that have come in already. Can you please explain the term nugget effect? In addition, please elaborate on the use of the term pebbles in increasing bias in milling.
Okay. Nugget effect is basically if you have your analytes or contaminants of concern that are present in particulate form. Classic example would be lead fragments from a small arms firing range. So in that instance, you've got an example of a very high concentration nugget or particle that contains a contaminant of concern. And when you have those types of situations where you've got that kind of small-scale heterogeneity, it can be very challenging to get an appropriate subsample. Now, with regard to the pebbles and the milling, if you think in some instances where you might have weathered pebbles, where, let's say, you've got naturally occurring arsenic, in some instances, the arsenic on the outsides of those pebbles may have been weathered and washed away, but there is still some that is trapped inside of those particles. If you leave them intact, then you will get one arsenic measurement, basically a little bit lower. But if you do particle size reduction or milling on that pebble, now the arsenic that had been trapped inside of the particle is now released into the measurement process. So the average measured arsenic concentration might be a little bit higher. Typically, the precision is also going to be improved as well.
For VOC ISM, when you're collecting 30 increments over a decision unit, do you collect 30 increments per core subsurface sample and combine all core increments for the DU into the sample container?
I guess I'm
not. That might be a good question.
Yeah, I guess I'm not real clear if you're talking about a single boring or core, or if you're talking about multiple borings or cores. Typically, what we've done in the past is we have our decision unit interval. Say it's 4 feet, and we're gonna. There's a couple different ways you can do it. One is you could basically collect an incremental sample within an individual boring or individual core. And so in that case, over the 4 foot length, you would take 30 increments and you would have your ISM sample over that depth interval from that one particular location. Typically what we're interested in is we're interested in a decision unit that has X, Y, and Z dimensions. So it's a rectangle, if you will. And so we're going to collect our 30 individual cores, and then within those individual cores, we probably would want more than one increment, so we would maybe, say, collect five or something like that, increments within each individual core, and then those five increments from that one core would be put into a sample container, and then the increments from the other 29 borings would be placed in that same sample container. So there's a couple different ways to do it. Typically, you're thinking about a decision unit that's, you know, has spatially XY coordinates with some Z depth. So you're thinking of a rectangle. So you typically want the area rather than the individual boring itself.
A question came in earlier. Are the decision units collected at stratified depths based on changes in the soil properties or geology, or is it simply based upon depth and interval?
Again, it really is a function of what your DQOs are for the site. It could be geology-based. It could be predefined depth intervals that are a function of either anticipated cleanup criteria, or it could be driven by your regulations in regards to the risk rules. You know, if it's a residential site, then we're concerned about 0 to 2 feet, and if it's an industrial site, you know, maybe it's 0 to 8 feet. So it really just depends. There's, you know, no right or wrong answer. It just depends on what you're interested in and what your objectives are for your site.
We have a question from a graduate student who's working with nanopesticides. Are the same lab conditions and tools effective?
Or nanopesticides? Well, I have to admit there haven't been any nanopesticides that have shown up on the analyte lists for commercial environmental labs at this point. We'd certainly be willing to continue that discussion offline once we get a little better understanding as to what the physical chemical characteristics are.
If we don't decon between increments, don't we run the risk of adding contamination to each increment collected after a high increment, the result being that the total amount of contamination that makes it into the bucket is higher without decon than with it?
Yeah, I mean, there's that possibility, but typically, you know, all the material in the sample container is being, or within your sample device, is being extruded into your sample container. You know, and typically the outside of the core barrel, you know, we'll brush off with our hand to remove that. You know, so if you got a, you know, a small particle, you know, from one increment location, you know, sticking to the core barrel and it comes off, you know, at the second increment location, it's really not going to affect your sample result. So, I mean, the volume from one location to the next is essentially going to be pretty constant. And so, you know, again, we're assuming that the mass is going to be about the same. So, you know, again, remember we're collecting 30 increments, and the mass of our increments is, you know, somewhere between 50 and a couple hundred grams. So, you know, in total we have 1,000 or 2,000 grams of material, and if you, you know, carry over a couple grams of material from one location to the next, it's really not going to, you're not even going to see it.
Yeah, this is Michael Stroh with Missouri. I'd just add to that. We used to collect rinsate blanks from our tool, from our sampling core, when we were finished with the decision unit before we went to the next one, you know, on some percentage basis. And we pretty much discontinued doing that because we found that, you know, even for highly contaminated decision units, there just wasn't, you know, any amount of carryover that was significant enough to affect the next sample. So that might apply to that question as well.
How is decontamination handled between vertical decision units?
So that case, the way that we've done it is, you know, as typical with normal drilling, we decon the core barrel, if you will, between holes, so between every hole. So, you know, again, obviously as you're penetrating through one vertical decision and into the next, you're not, you know, stopping and, you know, pulling out the core barrel, deconning, and going back in the hole. I mean, there could be some cross-contamination that might be carried over from the decision unit above to the decision unit below, but it's the same same problem that you would run into with conventional sampling. So it's assumed that there's minimal carryover. And again, you know, I like to often split my samples, especially for VOC samples, split my cores in half and collect the sample from inside. You know, for non-volatile samples, I'm going to, you know, collect a wedge of the entire core. So, that, you know, there could be some carryover on the external portion of the core. But again, the same issue applies to the previous example, that any volume of carryover or mass of material is going to be relatively small to the entire volume or mass of the sample.
Thank you. We do have several other questions, and trainers are going to follow up answering those questions directly back through the Adobe Connect, but we're going to continue on with the second half of our training class. Feel free to continue to ask questions, and we hope to have more time at the end of today's class to ask questions out loud. I'll now turn the presentation over to Tim Frederick at US EPA Region 4. Tim?
Thanks, Juliana. So this is our roadmap here on slide 76. Today has been all about implementation and how to use incremental sampling. We talked about field implementation, talked about lab processing, and now we're going to talk about making decisions. We've divided our site up into decision units. Ultimately, we want to make decisions about our sites. So in this module, we're going to talk about how we do that. We're going to talk about evaluating our data, identifying sources of error, figuring out what to do about those sources of error. We're going to talk about decision mechanisms and data evaluation. Decision mechanisms are things that we set up a priori for how we're going to use our data. Data evaluations, the data has come back from the lab, and we're going to figure out if we've met our data quality objectives. So we're going to kind of run through both of those. So as I said, decision mechanisms are kind of an a priori approach that is set up beforehand during our data quality objective sessions, our systematic planning. We're going to talk about what we're going to do with the data when it comes in. The ITRC tech reg lays out six common types of decision mechanism. This is not necessarily comprehensive, but it's sort of a way to kind of conceptualize what we're going to do with our data when it comes back, how we're going to use that to inform decisions and risk management. So we'll run through each of these. Decision mechanism one is pretty straightforward. We're going to take one incremental sample result. We've gone through and done a 30, a 50, 100 increment sample. We get a result back, and we're going to compare that to some action level. This is going to be something that you want to discuss with your regulatory agency up front. Is this sufficient? And in some cases, it may be. You may want to just determine, you know, am I well above or well below some action level or some level of concern? Is there contamination present or absence here? But if you're going to be using your data for like a risk assessment or something else, you may need to do a little bit more than this. Again, you know, when you're going through your systematic planning, having all of your project team partners, including the regulatory agencies, the facility or the site owners, the state, the feds, all on the phone and kind of agreeing up front is key. Decision mechanism two, if I can get this to advance, okay, here we go. So decision mechanism two is where we would take our triplicate samples, our three incremental samples, if that's what we've done, in our decision unit. We're going to use an arithmetic average to compare to our action level. Again, this is you know, one approach, and we might do something a little bit different for a risk assessment, which we'll talk about next. But this is our Florida case study when we were looking at decision mechanism two. Looking at our OU, our decision unit that we had set up, we looked at decision units two and three, which if you remember, were set up to kind of have some inherent variability, where they were kind of looking at parts of the green were included in those. And the idea was to see if our incremental sampling could capture that. So when we looked at the results here, where we have discrete samples of 30 discrete samples in a quarter acre, which is, you know, many more discrete samples than we would see at a typical site. We also took 330 increment samples and 300 increment samples. And you can see here that the, you know, our averages for decision unit 2 are fairly similar. In decision unit 3, we actually ended up with higher concentrations in our incremental samples than we did in our other units. And so, you know, this kind of gets to the idea that, you know, one of the criticisms that we hear about incremental sampling sometimes from some quarters is that we're diluting the sample. And in this case, you could see that, you know, decision unit 3, which had a little bit more of that green on our golf course, higher concentrations of arsenic, that's reflected in our sample. So that's good news there. The other, you know, important thing here is that as our number of increments went up, you know, we're kind of seeing, even with 30 discrete increments, 30 discrete samples rather, we're seeing higher concentrations in all of our samples. So that was an interesting finding for us here. Let's go to decision mechanism 3. And this is a typical decision mechanism if we're going to be looking for using our data in a risk assessment. What we do here is we calculate a 95% upper confidence limit. This is a standard approach in most risk assessment paradigms where we're calculating a conservative estimate of the mean rather than just the arithmetic mean, and using that as an exposure point concentration in our risk assessment. So let's take a look at what that looks like, using our Florida case study. In this case, we're looking at decision unit 1, which if you'll recall was a fairway. So we had fairly low concentrations of arsenic relatively on the fairways, and they were kind of consistent. So here, again, we had a quarter acre decision unit. We took 10 discrete samples. We had 330 increment samples, and we had 300 increment samples. And what's interesting here is our means are pretty similar if you look across the mean row there, and but our incremental samples are slightly lower. Our standard deviations is where we really see some differences here. As a measure of variability, the more increments we had, the less the lower our standard deviation was. And this is important because the 95% UCL is based on these two things, the mean and the standard deviation, are used in that calculation. And so you can see that our 95% UCL goes up, kind of reflecting that variability that we're seeing among our discrete samples, but that our incremental samples are very close to the arithmetic mean. And that's what we would expect in most incremental sampling, where we've controlled our variability, is that our, you know, conservative estimate in the mean is closer to the arithmetic mean than it would be for discrete samples. In this case, the outcome mattered because the Florida action level for arsenic in soils is 2.1 milligrams per kilogram. So if we were basing our decision based on discrete samples, we would have taken an action. With our incremental samples, we would not. We would have been below that action level. So that was, you know, certainly an interesting finding in our study with our in our case study. So let's look at the next decision mechanism. Is comparing samples to background. This gets a little tricky with incremental sampling and should be well thought out in advance. Here, what we're going to be doing is comparing our triplicate decision unit samples, ideally, to background samples that were collected in the same way. A similar size decision unit, triplicates, same number of increments, et cetera. The problem is if we were going to, you know, we can't do typical hypothesis testing to determine if one population of data is different from the other, because we, you know, in this case, we only have three samples, so we don't have the statistical power to compare our decision unit samples to the background. So we have to do, we can do some graphical analysis. We can plot our data to see visually is this different from that. But you can't do typical hypothesis testing here, and that's important to know and think through up front. Decision mechanism 5 involves combining data across decision units in a way that might be useful if you're trying to achieve different goals. So in this case, we have 4 decision units, A, B, and C, and D, where we've taken 30 increment samples. Now, we might want to, those might be something like quarter acre residential decision units or something, but the larger square may represent, for example, the home range of some animal that we're interested in an ecological risk assessment. So we would also want to know what the average concentration is over that larger area. So in this case, we can use our data to pool it and come up with a weighted average for the larger area, or while also having the spatial integrity of each of these 4 smaller decision units. And again, this is going to be something that you're going to want to talk through and think through. It's a little more complicated than most sites, but it can be done. Decision mechanism 6 is when we want to extrapolate data from a decision unit to some unsampled areas. And this gets a little trickier, but it's something that might be done when we have very, very large area that we're trying to make a decision on. There's nothing magical about incremental sampling that allows this over any other type of sampling that you might want to do. If we're thinking about a site that might be many hundreds of acres and we have small decision units and we expect that the contaminant has been distributed fairly homogeneously over that large area, think aerial deposition rather than a spill or something like that, or a surface application of a contaminant intentionally over a very large area, then this might be something that we could use to sample some subset of our decision units in order to make decisions over that larger area. But we would need to confirm that our underlying assumptions are correct, that the contaminant was applied similarly over these large areas, et cetera. Something like this, we would definitely want to have buy-in from all the parties, all the project team, before going down this road and having a clear idea up front, when this data comes in, how is it going to shape our decisions? How are we going to use this? So we've talked about decision mechanisms. Those are the 6 that are in the ITRC tech reg. There are other things that we could do, probably any number more based on the wide variety of sites where we might be trying to make a decision. The takeaway here is that we should have a priori criteria set up or an idea of what we're going to do with the data when it comes in. How are we looking at a simple data results compared to some criteria? Or are we taking an average? Or are we calculating some other statistic that we're going to compare to a regulatory standard or using a risk assessment? Or are we going to do something else with the data to make decisions? Always, it's maybe even more important, given some of the considerations for field implementation, to have buy-in up front so that when the data comes back, there's no questions about how things are going to be used. So now we're going to talk about data evaluation. When the data comes in from the lab, how are we going to evaluate that data or analyze it to kind of look at whether or not our data quality objectives have been met? So one of the things to consider are the potential sources of error. Central to incremental sampling theory is this idea of sources of potential error in our sampling and our analysis and controlling those to the extent that we can. And when we're talking about errors, we're not necessarily meaning mistakes, things that were done wrong. It's the statistical idea of the value that you're getting as compared to the true value. What are those potential sources of error that are introducing differences between our data and what's true or what's our true concentration? So we're going to want to think through what our potential sources of error are for our site. And they can be and usually are site-specific. What are the things going on here? How do we quantify that error? Can we put a numerical value to it that we can then evaluate it compared to other sites? We can interpret that error, and hopefully we can isolate the sources of error so that we can control them better moving forward. So some of the sources of error, many of these are listed in the ITRC tech reg, and these are some of the common ones. In the field, did we take a sufficient number of increments to control that underlying heterogeneity? Did we collect those incremental, each increment in accordance with the tech reg? Are they the proper volume? Were they collected from the proper depth? Did we use the right tools? These can, if not done properly, can introduce error. The field processing, do we introduce error there? If we were splitting samples with another entity, did we introduce some error in how we went about that? And importantly, is our decision unit the right size or shape? Sometimes, despite our best efforts, we find out, now that we have some data, we should have drawn this a little differently. And, what can we do about that? In the lab, the lab is doing, if you're not doing the processing in the field, the lab may either be doing it for you or doing some additional processing in order to get what they need to do the analysis. How they go about subsampling, was it a rigorous procedure or was it that, let's just grab a gram off the top of the jar? Are the extraction, digestion, analysis all done properly in a way that's maintaining our sample integrity, that we want it to be representative of what's in the field? Is that carried all the way through the all of the things that happen in the lab, including analysis? One of the things that's laid out in the tech reg is quantifying error. And the way that we quantify kind of all the potential sources of error is by calculating a statistic called the relative standard deviation. It's also known as the coefficient of variation. It's expressed as a percent. It's a very easy calculation. You take the standard deviation divided by the arithmetic mean, and you get a percent. So what does that percent mean? The ITRC tech reg tries not to define this number is acceptable and this is not. But experience and some other documents have shown that you're typically, if you can get a relative standard deviation that's 35% or less, that you're kind of that that's you will have worked towards adequately controlling your variability. That's pretty good reproducibility is what we're looking at. So a low relative standard deviation suggests that we've adequately controlled our inherent heterogeneity in soil to an extent that we're going to get reproducible data. We're getting some precision in our data. A high relative standard deviation can mean several things. It could be that despite everything that we've done, the soil at this site is just so heterogeneous that we're going to get variable results. It could mean that our DU has been drawn wrong. It could mean that our number of increments was not sufficient to control that heterogeneity and it needed to be smaller, perhaps. So there's when we have a high relative standard deviation, doesn't mean that the data is no good and we have to throw it out. It just means that we have to think about where that error is coming from and for our intended use. Is it acceptable or do we need to rethink something? One of the things that we can do, again, when we calculate that relative standard deviation based on just our lab data, that includes the heterogeneity or the variability from all potential sources, the field, the lab. Some of the things that we can do to isolate the sources of error, to kind of figure out where is this error coming from, is put forth in an EPA document, and the link is there at the bottom. This is from a dioxin-specific document, but it's applicable to really any incremental sampling program. And here what we can do is we can do triplicates or separate, you know, subsample one of our increments, one of our triplicate samples, and further into triplicates at the field prep stage to see if that's where our error is coming from, or at the lab prep, wherever the sample prep is coming from. Or we can then take one of those triplicates and subsample it further to see if it's at the extraction stage or wherever. And this can be, you know, a method of working through potential error if that's something that you really need to get your hands around. And there's more information at the link here. So we've talked about, in this section, about making decisions. We've gone into the field, and we've very rigorously collected our samples using our best systematic means of controlling our samples, our variability within our samples, rather. We got good data. We're going to evaluate that data when it comes in to make sure that we've met our data quality objectives to help inform our decisions about whether our data has achieved all of our goals or if we need to consider some additional options there. And that brings us back to Michael Stroh, who's going to talk about application of incremental sampling. Now that we've talked about the theory in day one, the implementation in the field and the lab in day two, as well as how to make the decisions, Michael Stroh is going to talk to us about opportunities to use incremental sampling.
Great. Thanks, Tim. Okay, so we're on to the last module now on applications for ISM. We can, you know, ask about where we might want to use it, although actually it might be more appropriate, knowing what we know now, to ask, to kind of flip that around and ask where would we still consider using a discrete sampling design. And there's really not that many that come readily to mind that I can think of, although one of them is one that we use quite a bit in Missouri, and that is to do initial screening to help define the shape of a decision unit or to get an initial handle on how severe the heterogeneity might be. And that's preferably done using a field analytical method, which you can do sort of in the same mobilization as you do the ISM sampling in. We'll do that quite a bit at metal sites using in situ X-ray fluorescence analysis. A second example might be, if you're working in a state or a federal agency where there are rules or policies that mandate discrete sample collection, you may kind of be stuck there. I mentioned before as well, with ISM, you're only going to get the mean concentration. So if you're after something, some other statistic, you might need to use discrete samples or other type of sampling design for that. But as far as actual applications, we'll list out several here on the next few slides. Basically, wherever you need to collect soil samples and make decisions based on means, incremental sampling would be applicable. And so I'll just go through a few of them to highlight how we can use ISM and how it might give you some benefits over a more traditional sampling approach. Residential yard sampling is what I'll talk about first. That's something we do quite a bit of here in Missouri, usually looking at metals and usually at former mining sites or sites affected by former mining activities. And when we started applying ISM to those types of sites, we quickly learned how important the systematic planning process was, because something even as small as a residential yard, there are a lot of different ways that you can divide that up and establish your decision units. So if you're, as an example, if you're coming from a risk assessor perspective, you might look at a yard and say, well, that's a single exposure unit. And so, they might advocate for setting that up as a single decision unit for sampling. But if you're coming from the cleanup perspective, or if you're holding the purse strings for a cleanup, you might look at that same yard and say, well, no, let's split that up into a number of smaller decision units based on what you might be willing to excavate should they come back dirty. You might also have a case where you might want to set up your decision units based on your conceptual site model, something that you know specifically about how the contaminants came to be located in a residential yard. An example of that, we worked at a site a few years back here in Missouri where we suspected a roadway was the source of contaminants 2 yards from haul trucks going through residential neighborhoods. And so we set up our decision units as sort of rectangular areas in the yard at various distances from the roadway. So there's a number of different ways you can do that, and just bring that up to highlight the importance of, again, of the systematic planning process at the beginning. You know, we've got, as a population grows and urban areas and suburban areas continue to encroach out into rural areas, former agricultural fields and orchards, there's often interest in redeveloping those. And so you might think about setting those up as single large decision units for a course screening step, or you may need to divide those into smaller units based on how you think exposure units are going to be set up for the development. And you can even randomly subsample a subset of those in the case that there's just too many of those to sample individually. And there's a case study in our guidance document in the appendix that goes through an example of sampling like that of a large agricultural area and some of the approaches that you can look at there. Soil stockpiles, that's another common sampling problem. And there it's important to think about your decision unit volumes and how, especially how you might want to use the material. So for example, let's say your project involves, again, going back to residential yards, let's say you're excavating yards and they average about 5,000 square feet. You're going to dig them up to an average depth of 6 inches. So if you calculate that out, that'd be about 100 cubic yards of soil per yard. And so if you've got a source of fill and you're not sure what's in it, you might want to consider establishing decision units for that source of about 100 cubic yards. And so there the idea is you're matching up your decision unit size with your intended use of that material. Post-treatment sampling, and I guess I would add pre-treatment sampling here as well. There's a common problem there where you might have encountered where you underestimate the contaminant mass that's in the soil based on a limited discrete sampling that's been done. And so then what happens is you find out your treatment has been inadequately engineered, or you end up with much longer remediation times than expected. Let's go on to the next slide. So we're on slide 97. Questions have been asked about whether you can use incremental sampling for very large areas. In fact, I think I saw one in the questions that came in over the break. And yes, you can. The photo on the right there shows a mine tailings impoundment here in Missouri that we sampled using an incremental sampling design. And the sampling part's fairly straightforward. Main thing you want to think about there is how you're going to set up your decision units. You know, and whether it's a mine site or a large agricultural site, you want to think about where you might have higher concentrations or source areas. And again, that involves thinking carefully about your conceptual site model and your sampling goals, future land use, all the things we talked about on day one of the training. Transect sampling is another common sampling problem. In the diagram in the lower right here, a conventional approach for that, if we have a railroad track we think is a contaminant source and we want to know how far out from those tracks the contamination might extend, we might set up a transect perpendicular to the tracks and then collect discrete samples at different distances out. But we know now that discrete samples can be up to an order of magnitude different, even if they're just adjacent to each other. And so that might lead us to a very large misunderstanding of what's going on with the spatial trends. We could tackle that same sampling problem using ISM by setting up a series of rectangular decision units, say a couple square, 1,000 square feet each at different distances away, and then collecting an incremental sample from each one of those. And that'll give us a much more reliable and reproducible estimate of what's going on with the spatial trends there. There's lots of other examples, firing ranges, munitions ranges that have energetics residue. I know Mark mentioned earlier the EPA's SW846 method for looking at energetics, when that used an incremental sampling method. That was method 8330B. Confirmation sampling is another interesting one. If any of you have done projects where you've done excavations with confirmation sampling, you know those can be a huge headache. It's fairly common to do your excavation and then go out with discrete sampling design, send those samples into the lab, and then one or more of them come back hot, which leads to another round of excavation and confirmation sampling. Maybe one of those comes back hot again, so you get into this kind of vicious and expensive cycle. A lot of that can be avoided with incremental sampling because we're collecting one sample that represents the average for the excavation floor and gives us a much more representative estimate of the mean. And actually, I know some folks are starting to do confirmation sampling in advance, so before the excavation is even started, with the use of soil borings. And so that way, they've got a fairly high confidence when they go out in the field. They know exactly how much, what the volume of soil that they need to remove. And then when they're done, there's no post-excavation confirmation sampling needed. So decision units sounds like kind of a new thing, but it's really not. We've been collecting samples and making decisions about volumes of soils for decades now. With ISM, what we're trying to do is provide a more systematic or science-based approach for doing this that can give us a high level of confidence in the results when we're done. And we'll switch gears a little bit now, and I want to talk about costs. Is that something everybody wants to know about? You know, ISM, well, what's it going to cost? Is it going to cost me more than what I'm doing now, or is it going to cost less? And the answer is it depends, really, on the designs that you want to compare. But one thing we can do is pull out some of the common elements for most sampling and analysis projects and kind of talk about each one in a relative way. And then in the next slide, I'll give a specific example of a cost comparison study that was done. So the planning stage, you know, for those of us a little less familiar with systematic planning or the decision unit concept, you might anticipate putting a little more resources into that phase of the project. Might be a little more expensive, at least initially with ISM. Now the field collection part, oftentimes it's going to cost more with ISM. The actual process of collecting the sample can be fairly straightforward and quick, but there's a lot of time in setting up the decision units, marking them out, doing the decon, and so forth. Quality control samples, those are typically collected on some percentage of your overall number of samples. And so since we're collecting so many fewer samples with ISM, there may be some cost savings there. Sample transport tends to be about the same, although, you know, if you have to ship samples a long distance, there may be some additional costs with ISM because the samples are so much larger in mass. Sample processing and conditioning, definitely more expensive with ISM there because we're doing those, we're asking the lab to do those extra processing and conditioning steps that are typically not done at all, and it's just on a discrete sample. It's pretty typical for a lab to charge anywhere from $75 to $150, depending on, you know, the specific steps that you're asking for there. So that's added cost. The per sample lab analysis cost, again, tend to be a little higher with ISM, and that's because we're asking the lab to use these representative subsampling techniques. They're typically not used for discrete samples. But since we are sending so many fewer samples into the lab, that tends to sort of wash out those other factors. And where we have specifically looked at cost comparisons, it tends to come out lower for ISM on the overall sampling and analysis portion of the project costs. And again, I would emphasize that's just the sampling and analysis portion of a project's costs. And I'll come back to that in a couple slides and touch on that again. But first, let's take a look at a specific example. There are a couple case studies in the guidance document in the appendix that where folks looked specifically at cost comparisons. They were both munition sites looking at energetics using method 8330B. Both of those saw found significant cost savings with using ISM, anywhere between 50% and 80%. But that was a study done back in the mid-2000s, and so we'll look at this example. It was a little more recent. It was done by the Army Corps of Engineers, and they were looking at metals in soil at a small arms firing range, and they divided the field activities. Well, they divided the activities for the sampling and analysis into three different categories you see here in the column to the left: field sampling, lab prep, and then the actual lab analysis. And then for each of those, they took a look at the per sample cost, so how much it cost to process and analyze each individual sample. And then they also rolled that into the overall project cost. And they looked at a couple different scenarios for their discrete sampling protocol. For their incremental sampling protocol, they collected 100 increments in each of their decision units, so that's fairly intense sampling, and they collected three replicates, so that's 300 increments per decision unit. That's quite a bit of work. And they compared that to a discrete sampling design that used 7 discrete samples per decision unit, and then a second design that used 15, so about twice as many per decision unit. And I won't go through all the cells in this table here, but if you look at the bottom row on the totals, what they found was that their per sample cost was higher with ISM, and again, that's because of these extra steps that we're asking the laboratory to do with incremental samples. But that was sort of swamped out when they took a look at the overall project cost, and they found that depending on the design, there was up to a 40% lower cost with ISM. But again, I would want to emphasize that these are just the project sampling and analysis costs. And, you know, whenever we do cost comparisons, it's important to kind of step back and look at the bigger picture, because it's fairly easy to, you know, sort of do the bean counting and estimate how much a particular ISM design will cost compared to a conventional design. But we also really need to keep in mind the cost of making a wrong decision on a site. So, for example, how expensive is it if I go out and over-excavate 500 cubic yards of soil that were actually clean? Or, even more importantly, maybe, what does it cost if I leave contamination in place that somebody could be exposed to based on a mischaracterization of the decision unit that was actually dirty? And in terms of field work, and this is particularly true whenever an investor is involved, time is critical. And so if you have to go back out and remobilize, collect more samples because either because we didn't do a good job during the planning phase or because we're relying on samples that weren't very representative, you can get into this situation where there's no clear endpoint, especially with a regulator. And that's a lot of times that's how projects die and sites become brownfields. So we want to avoid that, and ISM, with ISM we stand a better chance of avoiding those kind of situations. We can get in and get out of a site fairly quickly, ideally with just one mobilization, and we can get to defensible decisions and ones that everyone can have confidence in. So that's just a quick summary of ISM over our two-part training. And one thing we hear a lot is, you know, great, this is ISM is a great tool, another tool in our toolbox. I like to think of it more like ISM is actually a new toolbox. It was designed specifically to address the limitations of this typical traditional discrete soil sampling that we've been struggling with for a long time. And, you know, although we covered a lot of material in the last couple of modules of training, there's a lot more in the guidance document. And I really encourage everyone to explore that and take a look at the material in there. It's a great starting place. Although we started writing that guidance document back in 2009, and it came out, I believe it was 2012, so it's starting to get a bit of a rind on it now, and I know there have been some states that have come out with their own guidance. I mentioned Hawaii a couple times earlier. I believe they've got the most recent and thorough online guidance on ISM that I'm aware of, and if you go to the related links box there and look under additional resources, and you can find some links to those documents. Okay, and just to quickly wrap up, you can see here's a list of some of the main advantages, and I won't go through all of those, but just wanted to highlight that ISM, it was designed to address some of the limitations that we've had with discrete sampling for a long time, and some of the problems with efficiency that we've known about. We're trying to overcome those and make the whole process more efficient. And it's not that you can't assess a site and clean it up using discrete samples. It's just that presents a lot of problems and unknowns, and there's some problems with efficiency. We're trying to address those with ISM and provide more of a science-based way to estimate mean contaminant concentrations in soil in a systematic fashion. And with that, I just want to thank everyone for sticking with us today, and also for submitting some great questions. I'm going to go ahead and turn it back over to Juliana now for some final wrap-up and Q&A.
Thanks, Michael. We do have until 15 minutes after the hour to answer questions, so you are welcome to continue to send in questions using that Q&A box. And we do have a poll question one on the call to answer. Thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? So you're welcome to submit answers to that poll question. We are going to broadcast those results so you can see as they come in what other people are answering to this question. On our last slide, we do include a link to that additional resources, and Michael just mentioned several of the things available there. You can also download the PowerPoint presentation that you've seen during today's training class from these links. The Part 1 presentation is also available. We do ask that everyone on the call today fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback. It's also your chance to create a participation certificate for yourself. So at the bottom of the form, be sure to check the box to confirm that you attended today, and that's going to allow the system to create that certificate for you. Right now, the only way to get the certificate is by checking that box and submitting the feedback form. So if you forget to check the box, just go back, be sure to check the box, and hit submit again. We'll get to some questions that have come in so far during the second half of the training. One question is, if a soil stockpile is one decision unit and you collect 30 increments from random locations horizontally, should we plan random vertical increments within the pile?
Yeah, this is Michael Stroh. Yeah, if you've got a soil stockpile that you're considering a single decision unit, you would want you would want to collect 30 increments from that as a minimum, and you would want each of the increments to represent the entire depth of that pile. And so one way people have done that is to sort of spread the pile out in a way that it's of a more or less consistent depth, and that'll facilitate the increment collection.
Is this type of sampling something that laboratories can do rush turnaround on, or is the processing of the samples just too time-consuming?
Well, in large part, that depends on which processing options you want to use. Obviously, the more extensive the processing, the longer it takes. Also, if the lab is using air drying, the wetter the sample, usually the longer that takes. So, in general, figure ISM processing adding a couple of days to the overall analytical process, although in some instances we can use a subset of the ISM processing options if speed is more important than getting the ultimate in all of the processing done to get the the most precision out of the laboratory process. Sometimes speed is more important, and there are ways to come up with acceptable trade-offs.
We have a couple of different questions about applying this to sediment sites. Do you have a brief example of how ISM has been applied to sediment sites? Intertidal versus navigational depth or deeper areas? And another question, how about the application to sediment sampling? Do you use divers? The sampling, does it work to sample along a stream?
This is Michael Stroh. I'll take a stab at that. I haven't ever heard of anyone using divers, although I'd like to be involved in that sort of project. We have done sediment sampling using incremental sampling approach for shallow streams here in Missouri, just by setting up decision units that represent segments of a stream, and then collecting our increments sort of evenly distributed throughout that segment. We've also done incremental sampling on small ponds and lakes from boats using PONAR and coring type devices. So we sort of paddle around the lake and collect our increments evenly distributed across the lake. But as far as any deeper, like ocean sediment sampling, I'm not familiar with anything like that that's been done, although it may have been.
We have a question that's come in related to sites where there's attenuation. Since most attenuation models' mechanisms are related to initial concentrations, the average could in some cases significantly underestimate an out concentration. What are the trainer's thoughts about this?
This is Jay Clausen. I'll take a stab at it. You know, it's possible that an average concentration might underestimate the degree of migration. But you know, conversely, you know, if you use a maximum concentration, you run the risk of overestimating. So it really comes down to, you know, your modeling approach and how conservative you're going to be. I guess there's no really right or wrong answer in terms of how to approach it. You just need to think it through carefully and you know, decide what the objectives are and, you know, if the stakeholders agree with the process that you're going to use.
For a decision unit that includes the vertical as well as a depth, a 10-foot depth, could you collect adequate increments from 10 borings with 3 different depths from each boring or something like that?
This is Jay again. Generally, you're going to, you know, it's just like surface soil sampling, so you want to get, you know, a reasonable spatial distribution of your increments across the area. So, you know, again, just like surface soil sampling, we would want to have 30 increments. If you do, say, 10 borings and you collected 3 increments per boring, then you're not going to get the spatial distribution that you need. You know, if you were able to, split your cores into thirds using the wedge approach and you had your replicate samples, you know, if you look at the RSDs and they look reasonable, then, you know, that it worked. But if you get a higher RSD number, then, you know, it may not have worked. Yeah, I had a project a few summers ago where, you know, 30 borings was just going to be too much work. We had 66 decision units, so I compromised and went with 15 borings per decision unit. And, you know, in a number of cases, my RSD was, you know, between 50 and 100%, which is a lot higher than I would have liked it. But there really wasn't funds in the project to do 30 borings per decision unit. So, you know, sometimes you just got to have to, you know, weigh the risk of higher error associated with, you know, the cost of the project.
For sites that have been investigated using discrete sampling methodology, is it appropriate to do ISM for confirmation sampling?
This is Tim Frederick. I'll take a stab at that one, I guess. We keep kind of coming back to this. I guess it depends on your data quality objectives, how many discrete samples did you take in the first place. Our case study kind of shows the difference, in my slides today of, how we might have arrived at different decisions depending on how we took our samples. It just really depends. Did you take a sufficient number of discrete samples in the first place to be confident of what you're doing? If not, incremental samples could, if you're looking for an unbiased estimate of the mean, as a risk assessor, that's what I'm interested in. So I may ask the project manager to go back and do some incremental sampling so I can have some confidence in the numbers that I want to use for my risk assessment. But it's really going to depend on the particular site.
We have a question that's come in. We have ex situ stockpile regulatory guidance, which uses 5 samples in each of 10 cells after 250 cubic meters, with the 95% UCL used for the decision about each cell. How does that mesh with ISM?
Well, this is Tim Frederick again. The short answer would be I don't know. If you've got a regulatory requirement for what you're doing, then it would be up to the regulators to weigh in on whether they would consider doing incremental sampling or if you've got to do it the way that they've specified. And this is something that's been coming up on the regulatory side as a regulator. Certainly EPA has some policies that say, you have to certain samples in certain situations a certain way. And we've been kind of been more open to hearing about work plans with incremental sampling. I know that there's some states that specify a specific number of discrete samples for decision making, and they've been open to incremental sampling. So I would say if you're interested in doing incremental sampling to get a better idea of what's going on in that stockpile, that I would present it to that specific regulatory agency. But not being familiar with the ins and outs of that particular program, I would be hesitant to say more than that. But your sales pitch would be, I think we can get a better idea of the mean of what's going on in this using this approach.
Can discrete samples and ISM samples be combined when calculating 95% UCLs for use in risk assessment?
This is Tim Frederick. Again, as a risk assessor, no. That's the short answer. They're different things. I would go with one or the other. From the risk assessment perspective, the incremental samples, if we've done everything properly, is going to give us a more reproducible estimate of the mean. So if I had to pick one or the other, I would want to go with the incremental samples.
Any advice on applying this to deep soil impacts greater than 30 feet, where push technologies are generally ineffective? You partially answered this in a past statement. Can we reduce the number down to 8 borings per decision unit?
Yeah, so this is Jay again. You can, but you run the risk of having an unacceptable error. So really, the amount of error you can tolerate depends on your expectation on the contaminant concentration you're going to get and how close that number is to the regulatory threshold number that you're comparing against. So, if you're expecting your contaminant concentrations to be pretty close to the regulatory number, then you have a lower tolerance for error. And so the further you move away from the minimum of 30 increments, the greater potential for error. In the case where I had a project a few summers ago, I was expecting either to be non-detect or to have really high concentrations. And in fact, that's what I had. And so even though I only took 15 borings per decision unit, and I had a fair amount of error, that even when I put the uncertainty of the error and did plus or minus the concentration, I wouldn't have changed my decisions because my contaminant concentrations were so high above the regulatory value that even if I reduced it, I wouldn't have, you know, gone below the threshold. And conversely, on the lower end, my numbers were so low that even if I, you know, went on the plus side of the error, it wouldn't have thrown me over into an action. So, you know, you have to be careful when you think your contaminant concentrations are really going to be close to your regulatory number, because then, you know, a small difference in a concentration could throw you into an action or to no action, depending on where you're at with the site.
Thank you. We are out of time for today's class, and we have a couple questions that we didn't get to. If you asked a question and it wasn't answered or not answered completely, let me know, and you can email me at training@itrcweb.org. We can follow up offline with our trainers and post that question for follow-up. So again, if you have a question that you would like to have followed up, email me at training@itrcweb.org. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If you haven't already, please fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information, and appreciate you taking a few minutes to give us your feedback. More information about ITRC is on the website, www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.